why the deep structure of space-time should be something discrete and not continuous. My own personal favorite for a long time has been the evidence coming from black hole thermodynamics, which makes it natural to think of the horizon as composed in some sense of individual constituents of a round Planckian size and each carrying about one bit of entropy. However, there's a very simple-minded way of getting a length, which is familiar, I think, to almost everyone out of fundamental physics, which is just to take notice that from h bar together with g, and of course c, which I've set to 1, you can form a length known as the Planck length. If you think of that in analogy with the old formula E equals h nu, this thing tells you that when h is finite, there's a discreteness in energy. You could imagine that this tells you that when h is finite, by which I mean non-zero, there's a discreteness in size. Now, as I've written it, this is a length. Of course, if you square it, this equation, you get the fundamental area. And that plays a very natural role in the context of loop quantum gravity. If you square it again, you get a volume, by which I mean space-time volume. And that plays a very natural basic role in the context of causal set theory, as we'll see in a second. However, all this, of course, just by itself is numerology. It needs to be embedded in some more physical argument. The example I quoted from black hole thermodynamics is one, and there's a myriad of others. One way or another, this is, I think it's fair to say, has led most people working in quantum gravity to the belief or the expectation that around the Planck scale, the notion of a smooth manifold breaks down and something very different, possibly genuinely discrete, takes its place. In other words, there's a cutoff. And so the question arises, how can we hope to see evidence of this kind of cutoff? The cutoff could be of different sorts. It could be more sophisticated, like in non-commutative geometry, or more simple-minded or straightforward, I should say, like in causal sets, or something in between, like in quantum gravity, or perhaps string theory. But we can hope that by focusing on the most straightforward case, which is just the frank discreteness of causal sets, that we'll get an idea of what these kind of effects might be. Obviously, if this discreteness is a very basic feature of quantum gravity, then it's in some sense one of the most important things we could try to find evidence for. So in thinking about that, it's natural to make use of the analogy of discrete matter. We know that matter has an atomic structure. And we now have, in some sense, seen individual atoms, so there's no question of whether it's there or not, or what its evidence is. But in an earlier time, that wasn't the case. And you can go back and see, maybe about 100 years ago or so, what kind of things gave people evidence for the discreteness of matter, for the atomic structure, and see whether there might be analogs of those in the case of quantum gravity, which is when we're talking about the discreteness of space-time. So what are the different things that flow from discreteness of matter and might similarly flow from discreteness of space-time? Well, first of all, there's the cutoff itself. That's almost the definition of discreteness, so it's not something entirely flowing from it, but there are things associated with it. Basically, the ones I'm thinking of are relationships among the fundamental constants. So if you think, or the constants of not so fundamental, the derived constants. So if you think of something like the Debye length introducing a constant in statistical mechanics. In the case of space-time, there's a kind of analogy, I think, that I just referred to before, which is the value of the black hole entropy, the constant. First of all, the fact that the area of the horizon is proportional to the entropy, and second of all, the proportionality constant can be seen as evidence to the cutoff. But it's a very indirect kind of evidence, and it's something we already knew without directly thinking about discreteness. Another one that's been proposed in recent years that would be very dramatic if it would be found, which I don't think it will be, coming from the other side of quantum sets, but coming from certain points of view, it's been taken that symmetry approach, specifically the Lorentz group symmetry. This has a natural analogy here, which is condensed matter, which can come in the form of solid matter, say crystalline matter, fluid matter, or something in between like glass. The first one breaks symmetry. The crystalline structure breaks translational and rotational symmetry. So you see it in many ways, say by refringence, just to take a fairly exotic example of the crystal. But if space-time were similarly crystalline, or if its discreteness broke the Lorentzian symmetry, then you could expect to see modified dispersion relations. Of course, you see those also in ordinary matter. And that's been proposed. A lot of thought has gone into it, and very strict bounds have been put on it so far. It hasn't been seen. If it were seen, it would be dramatic. But as I said, I think it won't be seen coming from something, the point of view where your Lorentz invariant is actually forced on you, the preservation is forced on you. I'll come back to that in a second. That'll cross this off as a possibility, but it'll open up new, very different possibilities, which are mainly what I want to talk about today. Let me just finish going through these other possible applications or effects. Another thing that's historically very important in pinning down atomicity was the role of fluctuations as they affected such things as propagation of particles through a medium or propagation of light, of waves through a medium. In both ways, they had important effects. So if you consider propagation, say, of light, then you have the effect of scattering, Rayleigh scattering lots of small molecules. And if that has two effects, it's differential at different frequencies, and therefore it changes the color of objects, like the red of the setting sun or the blue of the sky. And second of all, it leads to a kind of extinction in the long run of the light wave as the scattering sets in. So there's a story, I don't know if this is true, but there's a story, you're shaking your head, maybe it is true. There's a story that Rayleigh was able to estimate the size of an atom by looking off at Mount Everest or some distant mountain. He was sitting somewhere, and on a very clear day, he could just barely see this mountain. And so the fact that even on a clear day, it was kind of invisible was the evidence of the extinction. And so he could work out the extinction probability for a unit length, and from that, deduce to a fairly good accuracy the size of an atom. So these are effects that could happen also. You could imagine in space-time, light propagating through a granular medium would have some sort of extinction. You could imagine that a particle propagating would undergo, the light would also have some sort of scattering. You could also imagine that a particle propagating through a discrete medium doesn't go straight. It undergoes, its world line shows small swerves. The famous example there is, of course, Brownian motion in the case of ordinary matter, where the swerves are everything. The particle doesn't have any particular drift or systematic velocity. And this is another thing that's been thought about and could, in principle, ought to exist in the case of space-time discreteness. The question is the size of the effect. I won't go into that, but there's some small hope that some of the origin of high-energy cosmic rays could be such an effect. In the case of fluctuations per se, there is also an effect that was proposed. And I believe myself that we've actually seen this effect. This is fluctuations in the cosmological constant that would be responsible for the acceleration of the universe, expansion of the universe that we're seeing now. So this is one thing that we may actually have seen, and it's the only thing in the whole list that we could make that claim for so far. On the others, we can just put bounds. Okay, so all of these things that I've talked about so far are just analogs of things that happen in the case of atomicity of matter. But there are two new possibilities on this diagram, which are new because they relate to a feature of space-time that it doesn't share with space, which is its Lorentzian signature. So I like the way here on the street side, if a new stoplight or a new speed limit comes here or something, they put a big sign with red jagged edges that says new, right? So these are the two, I don't have red at the moment, but these are the two new things that have to do with the Lorentzian character of space-time. And this one I won't talk about it, but I do want to mention it, which is that if you think it through in the context at least of causal sets, or more or less any discrete Lorentz group preserving kind of discreteness, that you would have a transparency at high energy. This is very high energy. So two particles colliding at sufficiently high energy wouldn't see each other. And so these cross sections would have to go to zero. This, however, is a typically Planckian energy. So I think maybe not quite Planckian, but extremely large energies. And so it looks unlikely that we'd be able to see that directly. But in principle, it's a very dramatic signature of the discreteness. And that brings me to the one that I do want to spend the rest of the time talking about today, although we'll see some echoes about these other effects, which is non-locality. So the claim is that discreteness, which does not violate the Lorentz group, necessarily implies some form of non-locality.
So can you say more about this transparency? Is it because like the Planckian energy becomes like infinite energy?
No, it's not because of that. It's because if you ask me again when I show a picture that has a long ellipse on it, and then I'll try and answer it better. It's basically because the elements of the causal set that carry the information about the two waves don't overlap. Their overlap goes to zero in high energies. So a highly boosted wave is carried, the information about it is carried by a boosted region of space-time in a discrete setting, a boosted region of the discrete object. And those two boosted regions don't overlap significantly when the energy, center of mass energy becomes too high. I can try and, if you want to ask afterwards, I can try. Okay. So I'm saying non-locality follows, I claim, and I'll make the argument for it, in pictures anyway, from discreteness plus Lorentz preservation. And in the context that I'll be discussing this, which is that of causal sets, I'll claim that locality, Lorentz invariance is actually forced on us. It's not a choice. That's why I said that I didn't have any hope, much hope of seeing these modified dispersion injections. So if there is non-locality, how would we see it? So I don't have any specific proposal here, but just some general ideas. It all needs to be worked out, really. But one of them is that if it's non-locality, and if the non-locality manifests itself at a sufficiently great length scale, then we'll see some sort of non-local field theory replacing, for example, quantum field theory. Similarly, in the non-locality, if it's manifesting itself on a large enough length scale, we'll sense things like space-time curvature, and it could have interesting consequences for, say, a scalar field in an expanding cosmos. So, for example, if inflation were right, then we'd have exactly this situation, and it could have observable consequences in that way.
But doesn't it mean if you have no local field theory, you would have to modify these partial relations anyway? So.
No, not in this particular case. No, not if you introduce non-locality in a Lorentzian way. So I'll give you a specific example, although it's not quantum field theory, but of an equation that is a non-local form of box phi equals zero. There's a k here, that k is a non-locality parameter. I'll define this object later. And I'll give you an example of that where the solutions of this equation, the free space solutions in flat space, are exactly those of the ordinary continuum dummy here.
Continue. So Lorentz invariance is something that you will hold because you really like it, or is something that...
No, that's an important question. So it's true, I like it. I really like it. But the argument that I would give for it is not that. It's that the basic assumptions of causal set theory, which are over on the other blackboard, I'll get to those in a second, actually force it on you. They force you to make the correspondence between the continuum over here and the discrete via a random process called the Poisson process, a random sprinkling. And that sprinkling, it's built into that that it doesn't violate Lorentz invariance. So the basic equation here, which I didn't write down, number equals volume. I'll just come back to that in a second. But the idea that the number of causal set elements is reflected in the volume of the space-time, in order to realize that successfully, it seems that you need a random relationship. That is, the causal set in relation to the space-time that approximates it. The causal set is something more like a fluid or a glass, and not like a crystal. It has to have its elements are, so to speak, randomly distributed throughout the space-time. And once you do that, then you're forced to have Lorentz invariance. So actually, state a theorem and so on that gives that a very strong point. So that's a very important point. It's not just that we choose Lorentz invariance, but that certain other things we've chosen force it on us. Okay, so as I said, what I want to concentrate on in this talk is this arrow here, why discreteness plus Lorentz invariance, or as Eric said, the deeper reason that forces the Lorentz invariance, why those two things force you non-locality. And then the somewhat surprising thing, which is that the non-locality, this to me was surprising. There are good arguments that the non-locality shows up on a much larger length scale than where you would have expected it, which would be the Planckian one. That's why it could have easily observable consequences. So here is a summary of the main points. The rest of the talk is nothing more than an elaboration of all these points. So in case I don't get to the end of the talk, let me go through this. Now, so the first one is that, as I said, that discreteness of the causal set sort forces you to have Lorentz invariance. So what's this thing that people always say, ought implies can, or something like that. So if it forces you, it better be true that you can have a discrete structure that respects the Lorentz group. That seems to many people counterintuitive, so I wanted to spend a little time showing you why that's true, and how, in particular, Poisson process realizes. Then, given that we do have discreteness and Lorentz invariance, what we cannot have, what we have to sacrifice, is locality. This implies that at the fundamentals level, which is the microscopic scale, presumably the Planck length, which presumably is about 10 to the minus 32 centimeters, although some people have argued for different values, that at that scale, we'll see a radical failure of locality. However, in the world of the familiar world that we live in, of course, local, as far as we know, there are no violations of locality that have been seen, although one can argue about the cosmological constant, if I'm right, that there has been one particular non-local effect has been seen. But leaving that one aside, we have no other evidence. Local quantum field theory is an extremely good approximation. So we have to be able to recover locality at some approximation at large scales, which I call macro scale, although it needn't be the very largest scales. And that's possible. That's just barely possible. But what you do have to give up, apparently, in order to do it successfully, is locality at some intermediate scale. I haven't said that too well. What I'm trying to say is that there was a radical non-locality at the microscopic scale. If you're careful, you can arrange for that to be hidden at larger scales, but not fully. So a residual non-locality will survive at intermediate scales, which seem to need to be much larger than the microscopic scale, what I call the mesoscopic scale. If that's true, then an effective theory that's valid at the mesoscopic scale would have to be continuous because you're already well above the grain size of space-time, but it would be non-local. And so the suggestion is that we should be looking for this kind of theory to show up at maybe at accessible energy. So these are all very general kinds of claims. I want to make them concrete by illustrating them with one particular problem, well-defined problem, which is how would I write down an analog of the D'Alembertian operator for a scalar field on a causal set. By scalar field on a causal set, I just mean a field or a mathematical object that attaches to every element of the causal set, a real number, say it's a real scalar field. So this is the analog of just a finite difference expression, what would be in a crystal and in lattice gauge theory, a finite difference version of the Laplacian. But the Lorentzian signature makes what was very easy in that case very difficult. It can just barely be done. And even if you do it, you seem to get this residual non-locality. So that would be the trend of the thought. I also already referred to the cosmological constant, which I think could be seen also as a non-local effect of discreteness. But that's not the non-locality that I'm talking about. So I said this would be in the context of causal centers, but before going on, yeah, I should say, as I said, and I should emphasize, the rest of the talk is sort of going through these points one by one and illustrating them and arguing for it. Before I do that, let me say a little bit about causal set theory, just enough to motivate the role of the Poisson process or the Poisson sprinkling. Every time I say Poisson process. But the Poisson sprinkling, because that will sort of be the basis of all the further developments. So the idea of causal set theory is, not everyone will necessarily know, is that the deep structure of space-time is a mathematical object that's what's called a locally finite partial order. That means it's characterized by some order relation. And essentially nothing more, no other structure. But it's discrete, there's not a continuum between any two elements, there's not an infinite number of elements like there is in Minkowski space or the real line, but only a finite number. That's the local finite. So, given this, how does the space-time, which is a continuous object, emerge from it? In fact, how does something like a geometry, which seems like a much richer structure, emerge from something as rudimentary, as just an order relation? The idea is encapsulated in this formula, order plus number equals geometry. If how does that work? Well, a geometry, a space-time geometry in the Lorentzian signature is characterized in part by a causal structure, a conformal structure, or what you might just call as light cones. And that's directly related to the order, because the light cones tell which elements of space-time or which points precede which ones and which ones follow in the causal sense. So order goes over to light cones, and then number goes over to volume. So the idea, as I said before, is that the volume of a region of space-time is just a direct reflection of the number of causal set elements composing that region. Number equals volume. That information gives you the volume element, the root minus g, in the continuum approximation. If you put those two together, the light cone structure and the volume element, then you have the full metric. But what's important for us here is that the correspondence, the detailed work, mathematical definition of the correspondence, is via Poisson process. That is, given a causal set, and given a space-time, which is a good approximation to this causal set, they're related as if the causal set had been produced by starting with space-time and sprinkling elements at random into it and taking the induced order relation. This random sprinkling of elements into some space is what's known as mathematically as a Poisson process. I won't give the definition, but the intuitive meaning is, I think, simple. The one-dimensional case is familiar to everyone in things like random arrival times or cosmic rays or whatever that you tend to study in probability
theory. So do you get a manifold by averaging over an ensemble of causal sets?
Well, in fact, even an individual causal set should be able to reproduce to a good some approximation the manifold. Right? If you averaged over it, then you would get in some sense, an exact manifold. In fact, I mean, that averaging will enter in this argument. But it's probably important to appreciate that even the individual one, to a good approximation, produces a manifold, just like even an individual distribution of atoms at this desk or something like that produces to a good approximation a smooth object. And this distinction, whether we really need to average or whether we need the individual one to work, will actually play a role in my argument. So that's another good question. So let me go back to this list of points.
The density is Planck of this.
Yes.
And in the dynamic expanding universe, it diluits.
Well, this is space-time density, not spatial density. So in a dynamically expanding universe, you would just have more elements being created. Okay, so that's another important question. Well, volume often suggests spatial volume, but here it means space-time volume, four volume, assuming we live in four dimensions. So the first point was that discreteness can respect the Lorentz group, given a Poisson, given a random correspondence between discrete and continuum. And furthermore, causal sets require this. I won't make the argument why the causal sets require them, but the claim is that, as I've already said, in order to get the number to be reflected, the volume to be reflected correctly by number in all different reference frames, you need this randomness. If you think of a regular distribution, it won't be uniform in most reference frames. So I should probably take a vote, but I won't. But just informally, it seems about half the people find it extremely, just completely obvious that a Poisson sprinkling is boost invariant, and half of them find it, I'm not sure that they still accept it, that it's true. Anyway, but you can certainly prove it, and I'll quote the theorem. Is this focused? It's good enough, I guess. So here's a computer illustration of that fact. So here's a random sprinkling into a portion of two-dimensional Minkowski space, the Poisson process. The causal relations are shown here, but the light cones are the usual 45-degree ones. Now, here's just a blow-up of that, so you can see more clearly. Here's the same region after a large boost. So instead of being square, now it's a parallelogram. And here's a little, it's not so clear on the slide, but there's a little region here which is, happens to be just chosen to have the same coordinate location as this blown up region here. You see that this is spread out in coordinates, scaled by the same on these two. You take that same region and blow it up, and this is what you see. So had there been a non-invariant, this should have looked somehow dramatically different from this. While in detail, of course, it's not the same, it's very hard to see any basic difference between them. The point is that a Poisson sprinkling after or before a boost is the same thing, it's the same process. Not only is it the same process, it produces something essentially indistinguishable from what you had before. So that if you use a Poisson sprinkling, then you will not be able to break Lorentz invariance in the sense of distinguishing a state of rest. And that was a pictorial illustration of it. Here's an actual theorem that one can prove. That's a precise theorem to that effect. So what would it mean to be able to choose a frame of reference, to deduce a frame of reference from a sprinkling of points into Minkowski space? If you could do that, then you would have to say that at least this question that, I forget who raised the question, but the distinction between the individual realization of the process and the process itself. A good example is a roulette game. So a roulette game, the process itself is rotationally symmetric, but the individual outcome is not. And the ball lands here, It's not hard to see that the Poisson process is, as a process, is Lorentz invariant. But you might worry that the individual realization was not, that you run it one time and you pick one frame, and you run it another time and you pick another. So this is a theorem that says even that can happen. This is just some mathematical preliminaries. The important part is this. Let F be such a rule. Suppose you could deduce a string from a string thing. What that would mean is that there would be a function that would take you from the space of all spring things into the space of unit time-like directions in Minkowski space, the space of rest frames. Now, there actually are such functions, but they're all gotten by a cheat. So here's an example. You give me the spring thing. I don't even look at it, and I always give you this direction as the answer. Okay, that's a function that takes a spring thing into a direction. But it's obviously not proving that there's a failure of Lorentz invariance. So what's gone wrong is that this function is not what can be called equivariant. To be an honest choice of a frame, it must have the property that if I do a spring thing and then boosted spring thing, and I got a certain direction from this spring thing, then the boosted spring thing must give me the boosted direction. It must commute, so to speak, with the direction of the Lorentz group. That's this equivariance condition. So lambda here being the action of the Lorentz. So suppose we have states of all spring things, which is a well-defined thing, and you have to look in a book on Poisson processes, you'll get the exact definition of it. The Poisson process is mathematically defined by giving what's called a measure, a probability measure, on the space of spring things, also known as the sample space. Suppose there were an equivariant function. Now we have to make one technical assumption, which is that it's measurable, which is about the weakest assumption you'll ever find in any mathematical theorem. Because probably, it's probably fair to say no one will ever give a concrete example of a non-measurable function. The reason being that in order to do so, you have to invoke the axiom of choice. Okay. So after with this technical assumption, then you can prove the theorem. There is no such F that exists. So what that means is that not only the process as a whole fails to select the frame, but each individual realization fails to select the frame as well. So even if we regard reality, space-time is just a single causal set, it still should not determine the frame. At least this theorem is, of course, in an infinite limit of perfect Minkowski space. It's not an exact theorem in a more realistic world that is only large, you know, only a good approximation to Minkowski space locally. But that's the best you can do. If you want to talk about Lorentz invariance, then it only really has a precise meaning in the context of Minkowski space. Anyways, the conclusion is that with probability 1, I should have said that. So there's a probability 0 that you will get a sprinkling that produces a frame. For example, you might get a sprinkling that looks like a statue I've seen that looks like this. And the sprinkling looks like that, well, you can obviously deduce the direction. But the probability of that is 0. So with probability 1, you don't get it. And so Lorentz invariance is built in a very strong sense. Now the second point was, although we can have discreteness, and we can, so that's the answer, part of the answer. We can have discreteness and Lorentz invariance, but we have to abandon locality. So why is that we have to abandon locality? So let's think of the particular task that I set myself earlier, which is to come up. So we have this causal set here, which think of that picture that we saw before, which is in two dimensions. And actually, I will now for a while work only in two dimensions. So imagine you start with Minkowski space of two dimensions and sprinkle elements. And you have a scalar field on that Minkowski space, phi. And you want some sort of finite difference expression that will reproduce box phi. If you can do that, then of course, then you have the makings of doing physics with that field. How would we do this? If you're used to sort of Euclidean signature, which most quantum field theories are actually done in, it doesn't sound like a difficult question. You just take some sort of nearest neighbor finite difference expression, and that should give you box phi. But sort of the central point of this talk, in a sense, is that that's very far from easy in the Lorentzian context. It's almost impossible. It might even be impossible in the extreme limit of an infinite space-time. So what makes it so difficult? So imagine that we have this scalar field. Let's see, in the continuum, suppose we have the scalar field and we're trying to define its D'Alembertian. So if we know it at that point here, we want the D'Alembertian at this point. If we know it at that point, that's not enough. But it's enough to know it in some small neighborhood of that point, an arbitrarily small neighborhood. But of course, in the discrete setting, there's not an arbitrarily small neighborhood. There's just a small neighborhood. So take this neighborhood. If we take, what would we do? We would take some sort of finite differences. We'd have the value here, the value at these red points. I hope you can see the red. This is meant to be green. I'm not sure you can see it. It's green. Does it look green? No. Okay. So these red, anyway, these red points, you would take these differences, these finite differences, and form some combination, and that would be the D'Alembertian. However, remember the Lorentzian, we have to write down some Lorentz invariant expression. That is, we have to write down some expression that's intrinsic to the causal set. And because of the inherent Lorentz invariance of the sprinkling itself, that will mean that the expression will be effectively Lorentz invariant. So if it brings in these nearest neighbor interactions, well, there's another nearest neighbor here. You can do any boost on these, and you'll get some other potential nearest neighbor. So the nearest neighbors in this causal sense are not just in the little neighborhood that we want, they're also spread out all along the light line. And those we don't want. The value of the field here has nothing to do with its derivatives here in the D'Alembertian. So we need some expression that somehow incorporates these and leaves these out. Well, why not just throw that out? The trouble with that is, if you throw that out, then let's take the same field, but after a boost. So after a boost, what was this nice little neighborhood that we could use to compute the D'Alembertian has gone into this long, skinny ellipse. So the relevant nearest neighbor couplings there are not to these points anymore, but they're to this sprinkled point here, which I can reach. So they're to this point here, and these become irrelevant. So we need an expression which somehow, almost by a miracle, contrives to make these contribute when the test field has this as a nice neighborhood, but it makes this contribute and this not contribute when the test field has this as a nice local neighborhood. Okay, so are there any, I hope that's clear, but that's somehow the main point. And that, it would seem that it would take a miracle to do that. If you think, for example, of the field phi that's itself Lorentz invariant, like t squared minus x squared, you might feel, well, you'll get an equal contribution from the whole light pulse, and it's just got to give an infinite answer. And I thought that myself for a while. But actually, it's not so. There is an expression that will do what we want. So how... Something else? So there is an expression that will do it. And why might, I'll just write it down for you on the next transparency, or the next opacity here. But before doing that, I want to try and motivate it a little bit. So let's go back to the finite difference expression that's familiar from the flat space. But suppose we had, this would never happen in practice, but suppose we were lucky enough and we got, here's the point A that's been, a sprinkled point has landed, and we want the D'Alembertian at the phi at that point. And suppose we were lucky and we got a point B and D that were sprinkled exactly on the light cone, or the light line in this case, at that point. And another one C here, so that this formed an exact square, or rectangle. Then the following expression is a well-known finite difference expression for the D'Alembertian. You just take the value of the field here, plus the field here, minus the field here, plus the field here, and then in the continuum limit, that'll go over to the D'Alembertian. So that's good, but now the problem that we saw here is that there's another thing equally likely, which is this long, skinny rectangle that we don't want to consider, where these points B and C have gone way outside the relevant region for that particular test point. So is it hopeless? Well, let's look at that expression again by this profound rearrangement, this profound algebraic identity that I've written. Instead of writing it as b plus c minus a plus c, I can write it as is it a minus b minus b minus c. If I rearrange it that way, then these differences are actually very small, because the boost not only stretches in one direction to preserve the volume for the area, it collapses in the other direction. So these are two very small things. Maybe if the field is slowly varying, they won't contribute so much. But that's an intuition for why there's a hope of doing it. Also, this was the picture I was referring to that's supposed to explain. So if the one wave is represented, it's very high boost by something like this, the other one is represented by a sort of transverse ellipse. And the intersection region is so small that there won't be any sprinkled points. And so there won't be an interaction region. That's a little telegraphic, but I
could you give your reference to environments and size and
oh, well, you might feel that since everything is Lorentz invariant, that if you had a function that itself was Lorentz invariant, that you'd get an equal contribution from every region. And so then the answer could only be zero or infinity, and not the true value, which is two in this case, or something, for the Dalman version of that field. Okay. Okay, so these are the general ideas. You can play around with them. Let me see if you can see. Yeah, I think you can see this, okay. This leads to the following expression after a bit of playing around with maple and whatnot, which is a first shot at a solution to this problem, writing down something that represents the null version. So the setup is as before. We have a two-dimensional Minkowski space, points sprinkled into a field phi, which should be slowly varying on the Minkowski space. And we're trying to write this finite difference expression only using causal set, we write expression that only refers to the structural properties of the causal set itself, not to the background Minkowski space. Not to the coordinates of the points, for example. Can we write down something that will, in some suitable sense, reproduce this to a good approximation when the spacing between the points, the sprinkling density, is high compared to the characteristic length scale of the function phi? That's the most we could ever hope to do. So we might, in particular, hope that in a continuum limit, we get the answer exactly. So here's an expression that does very well. You can see that it realizes the ideas I was showing on the previous opacity, which is sort of nearest neighbor coupling, but with some alternating signs that can cause things to cancel out. It turns out that the binomial coefficients enter here. So given that we want to find the value of the Dalembertian of phi at a point that I call the origin here, which is that black one, that filled in one. You take minus 1/2 the value of that, the phi of that field, and then the sum of all the nearest neighbors are what in the causal language you might call parents, all the elements of the causal set that are one, that are previous to it in the causal set sense, but with nothing intervening. So that's this layer one here. And I've illustrated what that would mean in this particular causal set. These are parents, this layer one. Then there's layer two, those which are you might call grandparents. So here's a parent, here's a grandparent. In this way of counting, this is also a grandparent, because what we're actually counting is the number of intervening elements. So here between this lower element and this upper element, the origin, there are two elements causally between. So that counts as layer three also. And then this is also layer three. Anyway, that's just the detail. You basically go back layer by layer. You take sum of all the phi's at the first layer minus twice the sum of the phi's at the second layer plus the sum of all the phi's at the third layer. That gives you an expression that you can also think of as gotten by just applying a matrix to a vector. So if you think of the causal set elements as if you index them by some index k, then you can think of the scalar field as a column vector with respect to that index, just a sequence of numbers. And then all we've done here is apply a certain matrix to that, this matrix Bik. So this formula translates into a formula for that matrix, which I've just written down here. On the diagonal is -1/2. It's next to the diagonal, so to speak, there's a 1 if I precedes k, and if what's called the interval ik, that is this num that consists of the set of elements that are causes between I and k. So this interval is the set of all them such that x precedes them precedes y. But that's combinatorics is called the interval. And when the interval is empty, then it's a nearest neighbor or a link. If the interval is one element, it's the first letter. If the interval is two elements, it's the second letter. And so on. So this is, and then I forgot to mention there's a normalization, the dimensional prefactor coming from the plot.
So why do you stop to third level?
Well, that's, I'll go on in a second. So I won't stop that. But the idea was we want something as local as possible, so just you'd like to limit yourself
rather
to your name.
Rather arbitrary, local. You could stop the second level, right?
No, you can't, turns out. I mean, it's more technical to answer that, but if you stop at the second level, it doesn't work.
Isn't it because you're looking at second derivatives?
That's a very good observation. I thought that, but I guess I'd have to say I no longer think it. The relationship is more subtle. You would think that that was right, but when we come to four dimensions, it seems that we'll need a third level. So that's all I can say. I almost motivated it that way also, but I thought that was too dishonest, so I didn't put it on the slide. But it doesn't seem to work in four dimensions. So what you can prove is that in the limit, as the sprinkling density goes to infinity, as the h bar goes to zero, as the Planck length goes to zero, this sum that I've written down here, not the sum itself, but its expectation value over all the sprinkling, so that gets to the question that came up before, that expectation does converge to the validation of phi. There's an assumption here that phi is a compact support, I should mention, arbitrarily large but compact support. And that might look difficult. It's not as hard as you might think to prove that, because these individual sums, after averaging, can be approximated by integrals that are not too complicated. Here I've written this in the lifelong coordinates and the null coordinates, so it's got a sort of exponential. It's got this exponential factor that looks only near the life, and then there's some. In this case, that's all there is. For that first layer. So all this would seem to be very satisfactory, but for one thing. What we proved here is that the expectation value converges. However, what about the fluctuations? What about, this is the individual realization versus the average. In the individual realization, it's not so good. The fluctuations not only don't get small as L goes to zero, but they blow up as L goes to zero. So now comes this question that was raised earlier. Is that fatal or is that not? My view for the rest of this talk will be, yes, that is fatal. We need an expression which even in the individual realization gives a good account of the D'Alembert. However, there's a little loophole here. You might try to make arguments, well, in the end, all we have is some ensemble, all that really counts is the average. If such arguments were true, then the rest, then I could stop here and the rest of what I want to say would not be right. We would have just a satisfactory realization of something like D'Alembertian. And we would have a radical non-locality, which is, I suppose I should have emphasized that the non-locality is radical at the Planck length because you had some over layers, and each of those layers goes back arbitrarily far into the past. So it's non-local, not in the sense of space-like, which is sometimes how it's used in, say, discussions of the EPR experiment, but non-local in the sense that it reaches outside any neighborhood. Okay, but if we need to get the fluctuations down, then we don't have a satisfactory expression. So how can we proceed? So let's think about it. We got the answer, we got the right answer from the average. So let's think about what this average sum is. If we start with a fixed scalar field and then we write this expression and average over all spring cleanings, then we just get a continuum expression. So we have some sort of integral kernel there, which I call d of x minus x prime, which has to be Lorentz invariant, because everything else having been Lorentz invariant. And when we apply the psi, it's giving us an approximation to the Dahlmann version of psi. If I write out what that kernel is, using the kind of integral I showed you and a few more, you get this expression here. So it's got this e to the minus c. This c here is the same uv, which is basically just the area between the observation point and the fixed origin where you're trying to compute the Dahlmann version. And then there's this prefactor k, dimensional prefactor, which is just what I've renamed 1 over L squared. So you have this exponential factor that holds you near the life function. There's a polynomial in that same area, that C, and a delta function. So it's just that simple expression. That would give us the average. Notice that it's a little bit non-local, but not very non-local, because the non-locality scale here is just given by the Klein scale. But the fluctuations are big. So how can you get fluctuations small? Well, by bringing the law of large numbers, right? By bringing in more contributions. So we could here's what we've done. We've taken a little skin of Planck thickness and only taking contributions from that. So the question of why did I just use the first two of something? Although your question was in the opposite direction. But anyway, well, this hasn't given us enough data to get the fluctuations small. Well, suppose we just thicken this and take a much bigger region and get contributions from all that, then we can hope to drive the fluctuations down. We can do that by decoupling, introducing this Planck scale parameter as an independent parameter and decoupling it from the Planck, making an intermediate length scale, which is much bigger than the Planck length. That'll give us, still in the continuum now, a non-local continuum analog of the Dahlmann-Gershon with an arbitrary non-locality scale built into it. So on scales much larger than 1 over square root of k, which is a zero momentum scale, so maybe it's not a length scale. On scales much larger than that, it'll give a good account of the Dahlmann-Gershon. On smaller scales, it's something very different. We can now turn around, that's what the Thun theorem is. We can turn back, go the other direction. Having come to the continuum by averaging, we can go back and say, what discrete expression would have produced this by averaging? And use that as a replacement discrete expression. So here's, I'm running a little bit short, it was starting quite late, but anyway. So I'll just rush through this a little bit. Here's the expression. It's a little bit messy, but it's just something easy to work out. This is an expression which has this other non-locality scale, k, but after averaging, it produces exactly the same continuum expression with the given k. This trick works, at least by simulations. I don't know. The other statement about the limit and so on is a theorem that has been proved analytically. The fact that this works is only checked by simulation, but it seems to work. So we have a non-local. We have this more non-local expression that works on the causal set. So in fact, we've got what we wanted, and as a byproduct, we've also got a purely continuum expression that has a non-locality scale built in, and that can take the place of the Laplacian.
So I just have a question. So don't you still get modified discretion relation in these fluctuations in each given case?
Well, So
shouldn't there be a fluctuation on that?
This has not been simulated yet, so I can't tell you for sure. But I think there's strong evidence that you won't, which will be this third point here. So actually, that's sort of completes what I wanted to. That's the argument I was trying to make, that substantiates the different points of the general scheme. Now the question is, so that's where we are now. Is we have this, and the question is, what to do with it? What kind of affects the way objects of time, what kind of question should we be looking at now that we can do this? And so one question, the first question, so this is from, I'll jump to this first, because that addresses what you just asked, is that you might worry, well, we did some sort of discretization. If you've ever actually worked with a computer solving differential equations, you know that half the time, maybe more than half the time, when you discretize something, you get some ridiculously unstable expression. And it doesn't work. So how do we know that this won't suffer from a similar instability? So as I said, the only real proof of the pudding would be to simulate it or to prove a theorem on it, which hasn't been done. But we can look at this. This discrete expression was derived from the continuum expression, this with the non-locality parameter built in. We could ask whether that continuum expression leads to a stable evolution. And here the answer is clear cut. Yes, it does. In fact, in a Minkowski space, sprinkled with perfect and no curvature and no infrared cutoff, if we look at that continuum expression, then and ask what are its solutions. In other words, if we write this equation of motion in the continuum with this non-locality scale and ask what are the solutions of that, the answer is exactly the same plane waves or exactly the same solutions you got in the continuum expression. But the solutions don't depend on k. So in particular, no instability has been introduced. And it also means that no dispersion has been introduced. So to the extent that the discrete one reflects to a good approximation, that average versus the continuum, we wouldn't expect to see the dispersion relation modify. And then I think one can make a stronger argument, which is that based on this theorem of the Lorentz transformations that I quoted before, that if you modified it in some way, that would be a rule for picking a frame. Right? I mean, there'd be some frame in which the dispersion relation looks simpler. This is just the ordinary Lorentz transformation. There's no deformed anything.
Yeah, the thing you said is that, of course, the sprinkling is not exactly the same. It's just that one average.
It's not exactly, absolutely.
So but in the same way, we have like deformed dispersion relations. If you get to that scale as well.
But suppose it were true that you got a modified dispersion relation from each individual sprinkling. Mm. Then I could take an individual sprinkling, take the dispersion relation that I get from that, take the distinguished frame corresponding to that dispersion relation. That's a rule for passing from sprinkling to frame. And that theorem tells you that that cannot be such a rule. Just to mention that in four dimensions, there is an analogous expression. The theorems haven't been proved for it, and they need to be, but there's no obvious reason why it won't work. You can work out what the nearest neighbor form is, the simple original one, and it's this. It has, again, the binomial coefficients, but now for 1 plus 1 cubed. What can you do with this? You can study propagation of a field on a causal set and look for all those effects I talked about, extinctions, scattering, swerves. Another very interesting thing is, can we do a quantum field theory version of this, starting from this expression or some similar expression? People have thought about this. John Mothert is here, but not here, has worked on such theories. And the motivation was often that it would remove the infinity, that it would somehow regularize the theory. And in that context, it was that reference, an important observation here, is that this sort of non-locality appears not to remove the infinities. It actually appears to make them worse. But on the other hand, what it does appear to do is allow an invariant cutoff, and that opens up a route to a new approach to renormalization theory, which has an invariant cutoff and is all done in the Lorentzian signature without a whip rotation. And of course, since I'm sort of out of time, I'll just not say more about that, but just close with the closing point, which is since what I've argued is that we can put together, in fact, from causal set point of view, we must put together discreteness and Lorentz invariance, that when we do so, we get a radical non-locality. But we can bring that non-locality under control to some extent, but not fully, in the sense that it will survive on a much larger length scale than just a function. So the question whether we can observe this is really essentially the question of how big is this mesoscale on which the non-local would have to show up. And here I only have a preliminary thing to say, but a very preliminary hand-waving estimate indicates that it may be quite large, even maybe too large. And why is that? Well, remember, we're trying to get an accurate approximation to the D'Alembertian. So we have to make the non-locality small enough so that it's not 6 centimeters, because then the D'Alembertian won't be the D'Alembertian field with the wavelength of the centimeter. On the other hand, if we make the non-locality scale too small, the fluctuations become big, we lose the effect of the large numbers. So there's a kind of balance. And so it appears that, and the balance depends also on the infrared cutoff, because each element is contributing, if you remember. So the more elements there are, the larger the fluctuations. So if the infrared cutoff is identified with the Hubble scale, the microscopic scale with the Planck length, then the hand-waving estimate seems to show this. You need this relationship for the mesoscale. If you put that in, that is if you want the sound version to be point-wise accurate in each realization. If you put that in, you get something around nuclear size, which is on the one hand exciting, on the other hand obviously worrying, because it might be that it's so big that we should have seen it already. So it seems to be on the verge of either having something very interesting or maybe something that would rule out this line of argument altogether. And so with that, I'll stop.
This is just a scalar field. What about fermions?
Right,
chiral so all fermions in particular, they're notoriously difficult to put onto lattices.
In fact, right, so I don't have an expression for fermion. In fact, even for a gauge field, there's no obvious expression. The thing that makes the scalar field so easy is that the object you want, the D'Alembertian, is itself a scalar, so you just have a map from scalar field to scalar field. Whereas if you write down the equations of motion, say Maxwell's equations, they involve, you have to put a vector on the lattice. So, I mean, you can do it in a sort of hokey way, but I don't know at this point any natural expression either for a vector field, say a gauge potential, or a fermion.
So what should you see if this is, like, if instead of nuclear size was 1 meter, what would you see?
Well, that's the question I'm raising. So I'm not sure. I mean, if it was 1 meter size, then you would see all kinds of, I mean, even the Coulomb force would be different. I mean, of course, we'd have to use this literally, as Rob was sort of alluding to. So far, we need a scalar field. If we make scalar field a kind of surrogate for light or something, then at 1 meter size, so you would see. So I think it went by very quickly. I think I had it somewhere on the transparency. Oh, here it is. I didn't even say. So the solutions to the absolutely free motion are unchanged. This is in the continuum version, the continuum non-local theory, but what does change is the response to sources and the response to curvature. So, like, when you talk, I mean, you're talking with sound, not light, but if I look at you, so I see, because of Huygens principle, I see whatever, just with a small delay, I see whatever source, you know, wherever the source produces, kind of image of the source, just with a small delay. But in this case, so that is the value of the value of psi, if I put here a source instead, 0, then the value of psi at some origin depends, here's the source J, it depends only on what the source is doing right there, right on the past light. But with this non-locality, it depends, it's still causal. I should stress it's a non-locality, but not an a-causality. Still only looks at the causal test. But now it'll depend on the source all the way back, some sort of interval. So you'll get very blurred results, and you would it can move rapidly enough or something. You know, see, blur. So I think there'd be very dramatic differences, although it would be nice to work out specifically a range of them. That's at the classical level. What you see at the quantum level is a very interesting question. But that would need to carry this farther and make the quantum field theory based on this kind of kinetic term.
Thank you.